Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we never give the ball away in association with AllFootballShirts.com. Well, it was quite the frustrating afternoon at the Amex on Saturday, as despite 72% possession and 33 efforts on goal, we found ourselves having to come back three times to earn a point against Brentford. But we'll just have to draw a line under that one, as the games are now coming thick and fast as we travel to Bournemouth on Tuesday and then to Spurs on Saturday as we try to maintain our push for European football next season. Joining myself and Alan Wares today is a man who, if you told him we were challenging for a Champions League spot, then he would probably thought we are quite mad. But after making 223 appearances for us, scoring 14 times, he would have relished the opportunity to feature in this midfield under Roberto De Zerbi. Ladies and gentlemen, fresh from hanging up his boots, please welcome Dale Stevens.
Hello, Dale.
Hello, Dale. Good evening, gents. Good evening. Hope all is well.
Yeah, all is brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us, Dale. It's been quite the journey for you, isn't it?
It has, and thank you for having me on. It's a privilege to speak to you guys. It has been some journey, you know, a long 16 years in the game, and excited for what's to come, really.
I mean, we'll start at the beginning in a minute, but let's start with the news from last week. Was there one particular thing that made you hang up your boots, or was it a combination of things? What were the things that went into your final decision?
Yeah, there's a lot of factors, really, in terms of why I ultimately made the choice. But I think over a period of time, the reasons probably started to change a little bit. You know, initially, I was out of contract in May, June time at Burnley. In that period from I did pre-season down at Brighton, which was obviously brilliant and fortunate to get the opportunity to still train at elite level, basically. So I did that for three weeks. And then I went for a period of like 3 months training by myself until I linked up with Stockport. My old manager took me back. My old captain took me back to Stockport to train. Yeah, he was my captain at Bury all them years ago.
Yeah, he was playing when you made your debut.
Is that him with the long throw-in?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah, so I went in there for 5 or 6 weeks. I ended up pulling my calf, which was about an 8-week injury. And it's not ideal in terms of being an out-of-contract player. Because I guess, obviously, the situation you're in, you need to be ready to go. You need to be training all you can.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and be ready to go when, you know, the phone rings, essentially. And I also had the period of, we had the World Cup on. Like, clubs are probably at championship level, weren't really signing players, so to obviously pay them through the period of where no league action taking place. And then just around the corner was January, where obviously the market's open. Along the way, I had a couple of injuries. Trying to train for like 3-4 months by yourself probably took its toll a little bit. You know, I wasn't probably getting to the level that I could train to if I was obviously connected to a football club. And I also had a long-standing ankle injury, which you probably might remember. I first did it the first year I signed for Brighton.
Yeah.
So a lot of them things, you know, probably made my decision, I think, post-February. I think when February came and went, that was probably the right time for me in my own mind.
Yeah, because when you're training on your own like that, and you're not getting the medical care you would be if you're under contract anywhere, are you? And they're at Brighton, Malcolm Stewart does do it still, but he's got a little clinic down here, down in the marina, I believe. But you know that you don't have the day to day support that you would actually at the football club.
Yeah, and that's the challenge of being a non-contracted player. You know, I didn't really know or expect, you know, what was to come. It was the first time I'd probably been out of contract since I think I did a day where my contract ran out when I was at Brighton before I signed my new contract. Right. But apart from that, I was obviously unsure of what was to come. But yeah, the challenge is difficult. You know, I sort of knew what I needed to be doing in terms of I would work Monday, Tuesday, be off Wednesday, and then do again Thursday, Friday, Saturday. In terms of like a footballing schedule, that's keeping it quite similar to what I'd be doing like if I was training inside a club. But you're isolated, aren't you? You're not really competing against your teammates. There's not really any competition. Your training is more just really straight line running. and it's not replicated in terms of what you would do in a football club. So it did become difficult. Yeah, and in terms of seeing like physio to keep, you know, your ongoing issues, I was obviously 33 years of age. I'd not played much football before that. So it all became very challenging. You know, I've from obviously the time I signed up Brighton in 2014, the ankle issue I had, actually it's got arthritis in it, and I've had probably that for the last 5-6 years. Yeah. So to deal with that is one thing in terms of being in a football club, but being sort of on your own, it was a difficult period.
So, but what it sounds like we're talking about here is that, especially with, I'd imagine that a lot of footballers probably feel the same when they decide to take that plunge and saying, you know, my boots are being hung up now. And I remember Steve Sidwell talking about it 3 or 4 years ago when he had to retire, is that it's not just a, you know, the physical aspect of it, the ankle, you know, the arthritis that you're talking about is one aspect of it. And that's your body saying, you know, ease up, sunshine. You know, you're not going to, you know, the recovery times are going to be longer and so on. But it sounds like there's that kind of, you've mentally prepared yourself to do it. It's like, or what's coming across is you've come to terms with it fairly quickly, and the mental aspect of it is hopefully going to hold you in good stead.
Yes, it is. You know, you sort of go through different emotions. Obviously, when I left Burnley, having not played so much, you know, I was still fit in terms of I'd trained, you know, for the period that I was there. Mm. So my body was in good nick, but it sort of like deteriorated in terms of, you know, you're not in a football club, essentially. So when I first left, I was excited for a new challenge, new football club. And then obviously when that period just got longer and longer, I could feel my body while I was training on my own. Like one day to the next, it'd be difficult. And then after a period of, like I said, 3 months, I was going out on the pitch, and then the challenge was more mentally.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting pain from my ankle and obviously my calf after that. And in the end, I was probably post-Christmas and thinking, yeah, I can't really do this. And sometimes I was walking off the pitch in pain after like 15, 20 minutes, and I sort of knew. So obviously post-Christmas, I probably knew my body wasn't up to, especially going into a football club ready to play.
Mm. That is your body basically giving you yourself the hairdryer treatment, saying enough.
Well, you had a lot of practice. I mean, because obviously you have the whole come down of you know, having that adulation of playing in front of thousands of people every week to nothing. And it's like,
Andy, just rub it in, why don't you?
Well, no, but you know, I mean, we just come out of lockdown as well, so you kind of had that whole thing where there wasn't. I think actually, you know, with Glenn Murray's last game as a professional footballer, when he was at Nottingham Forest, it was this forlorn image of him wandering around the city ground, looking at the empty stands, and thinking, "Well, this is the last time I'm going to do this." And
it's but to be fair, that's the best round of applause he ever got there.
Well, that is true.
Listen, let's go back to the beginning, Dale. Let's go back to your roots, as Odyssey once said. You're a lad from Bolton. Growing up, who were your heroes? Who were your team?
Well, obviously, a Bolton fan. All my family are Bolton fans. A great day for us yesterday. Yeah, but in terms of that era, obviously, Sam Allardyce being manager, JJ Okocha, he was my idol. I never went and took any of his game into my game because it would be impossible. But he was the guy that I looked at playing for. Yeah, and he was the best player of the team, and I'm sure that's what all the kids are looking at now. And we had the same problem.
It was from another planet, wasn't he? It was some of the stuff he could do. It was just absolutely wonderful to watch.
Free, wasn't he? He was very free in terms of his game. He was Big Sam's main player. He would do tricks. He would do tricks in his own half. It was great entertainment for a young fan.
Yeah, well, with that team, you know, you had Jorkev in there as well. He had, it was a Spanish fella, Campo. He was there, you know, it was a pretty, you know, there's some real big stars in that team back then.
There was. And to be fair, I wasn't one to like go and attend every single match. I would more be watching the highlights. I preferred to play it rather than go and watch it as a kid.
Yeah.
But yeah, because my whole family were obviously Bolton fans. That was certainly the club that I was supporting when I was growing up. Yeah.
So who's your greatest inspiration, your inspirational mentor for when you started getting into playing football as a lad?
Just the players I used to watch on TV. Obviously, you have all the family backing. Parents have been great, massive sacrifice in terms of driving up and down the country. But in terms of actually wanting to be like somebody, from being 14, 15, it was always Stephen Gerrard for me, always.
Yeah.
Even though he wasn't a Bolton player, he was obviously the player that he was representing England at the time. He was a main man, and, you know, he was the one that, you know, I looked at and thought, yeah, I could see myself trying to be half as good as him, I'd be all right.
I mean, Dale, at this point, I probably should point out that Al is the founding member, chairman, secretary, and life president of the Dale Stevens fan club. So,
well,
you know.
Yes. And can I just point out that when Behram Kayal won player of the season, they picked the wrong of the two centre midfield players. No, I've got a problem with Behram. Far from it, but sorry, you know. I mean, don't get me wrong. I was fighting a lone battle. But I would still say to this day, Dale Stevens should have won it. But but we'll come to that in a bit.
Yeah. Okay, but how did you end up at Bury?
Oh, to be fair, I've not told this story many times. So what it was, I was still playing Sunday League football at 15. I'd been through a year, well, not even a year, probably 8 months at Man City as a 12-year-old. But my football in development was more grassroots. It was more playing Saturdays and Sundays.
Mm.
And our manager at the time, he was folding after the age of 16. The team wasn't carrying on. So what he did, he wrote, I think, three letters to each. It was, I think it was Wigan, Everton, which was slightly ambitious.
Yeah.
For someone that's played grassroots football. Yeah. And Bury. And my Sunday League manager, Tommy Toole, he wrote letters to all of them asking for a trial, if there'd be any opportunity for a trial. And he received a letter back from Bury. And what they did, they invited 25 players down to the training ground, just to have a game between ourselves. And to be fair, I'd only played centre midfield, I reckon, for 3 months before this trial. Right. I was trying to be a striker prior to this. So I turned up at this trial match, managed to score twice from centre mid. A lot of people won't believe that, but even I actually did.
No, I wouldn't believe it.
And so I scored and played well, and it was Chris Casper and Chris Beach, who were obviously doing the scouting for the under-18s youth team at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I played well on the day, and then he invited me back for a 6 weeks trial. I played for the youth team in the first week, scored for them. And then by the third week, I played for reserves, which is obviously a mix of what used to be like old first team players who are not playing.
Yeah.
And then the young lads coming through, and I managed to score at Carlisle away. And that's when I got offered the 2-year scholarship at Bury, which is, it's not a normal way to get into an academy, but it worked for me.
Yeah. But you did make your debut for them. Chris Casper was the manager of the first team at that point. And I mean, it was a 76th minute substitute you came on in a game you lost 3-0. Can you remember much about the opposition that day?
Played Peterborough, didn't we?
You did.
I wore the number 34 shirt.
And
I remember that day.
And one of your soon to be teammates was in the opposition.
Soon to be teammate. Give me a clue. Who would that be?
CMS.
Yeah.
Oh, did he play that day? Did he?
He scored.
To be fair, he's been there that many times. He probably was there that day.
Yeah.
But you only made a couple of appearances that season. You did actually go out on loan to non-league Drawsden for a little bit. How did that materialise?
We had a player called Chris Brass who had links to, I think, to Hyde. They got to Hyde first and then Drawsden. We went to Hyde and he had links. I think he was doing a bit of coaching there, doing his badges. So that's how that came around. You know, the manager wanted me to play men's football, essentially.
Hmm.
And Chris Casper was great with, obviously, the young lads. He was our youth team manager, so he knew us all quite well. You know, and he advised me to go out for a month, maybe two, to go get some football. And, you know, I enjoyed it, really enjoyed it. I remember being so nervous obviously playing men's football in front of the floodlights. I'd only made my debut and maybe a couple of appearances for Bury. So it was all quite new. I think it was important for my development, especially at that time.
Yeah, that area of the Northwest, though, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, obviously, there is a lot of clubs in very close proximity to each other. I think you played for most of them, actually.
you beat me too.
But
that,
I mean, you did. I mean, you did end up at Oldham, and your stats for Oldham were incredible.
Yeah, and actually, before you answer that, Dale, can I just take a snapshot here? Because we must be talking to as about an 18-year-old here, aren't we? By this time, 17 to 18. My question would be, and it's jumping around in your in your career a little bit, but when you were at Oldham or just left Bury to go to Oldham, did you ever sort of think that, you know, in 6, 7, 8 years' time that you would be a Premier League regular? Did you have the faith and confidence in yourself at that time that you think you could make it that high?
No would be the short answer for it. I think I knew where I was, and I've said this many a times. I never really looked that far. I just tried to do my best wherever I was in terms of week by week and just see where it got me. You know, yeah. And I'll say that to the young lads that I speak to now. And, you know, if you don't get the things right in the short term, that long term picture changes so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, those stats at Oldham, I mean, they would actually eventually get you a move down south, actually. But I mean, you only played 58 times for them, but you scored 11 goals from midfield, which is incredible.
I did take quite a few penalties, to be fair.
You see, that didn't come up on Soccer Base.
Yeah, but once you sign for Brighton, you take penalties, then your stats are completely screwed.
Well,
mate, everyone.
I'm not sure who was on the pitch that day when Leo launched one into orbit, but it was...
Well, we finally have a penalty taker who knows actually where to stick it. Nothing personal, Dale, but I do, you know... Well, listen, the entire squad from with Dean to Wembley have been skying penalties for the Albion, so...
Yeah.
Sorry, Eddie Carey, I'm just ranting.
Well, you know, eventually, well, the one at Charlton this year was that kind of like...
That was all of them.
That was all of them. But, yeah, I mean... Exactly. You were there. I mean, how did you end up going to Southampton?
They were in League One at the same. They were in League One at the same time, and I think at that time we wasn't really in a position where the club thought we were going to get relegated. And I remember obviously we played against Scunthorpe. I don't know if you remember in the cup.
Yeah.
And Nigel Adkins would have been the Scunthorpe manager, who then went on to Southampton. So he knew me from obviously that game, and then they got an injury to Morgan Schneiderlin. So then I get the phone call and. You know, it's essentially, do you want to come for the rest of the season? Just to fill Morgan's boots, essentially. It was a no-brainer for me. It was a huge football club. And they were, I think they might have been top or it might have been even second in the division.
Would you like to remind everyone, Dale, who did actually win the league that season?
Yeah, I was on the bench at the Amex, not the Amex, at the Wigan.
Are we keeping up? I mean... it's.
Are you familiar with this this sort of ribbing, this are you keeping up things, Dale?
I'm not. No, I wasn't there for that long.
What had happened was that I think that in the game at St Mary's, Nigel Adkins was asked, "What do you think of Brighton's chances this season?" Bearing in mind that from the 25th of September, you think I have to look that up. From the 25th of September through to the end of the season, Brighton were at the top of the table, and Adkins went, "You know, how you know?" Someone asked him, "How do you think we're going to do? Brighton will do?" And he said, "Well, if they can keep up with us, they'll be all right." Which was. You know, that was just about every single one of Gus Poyet's team talks done for him.
I can imagine. Yes. Yeah, I can imagine.
I mean, the final stats say that, you know, we won the league by 3 points, but at the time that we actually were crown champions, I think we were 15 points ahead. So by the time you came to Withdean, what a lovely... And I'll ask your opinion of that place in a second. We'd already won the title, and I think, you know, the players were on the beach a little bit, but... You can see, I mean, this is again fast forwarding to Brighton. You could see how far the club had fallen because, let's face it, with Dean, must have been probably far worse than anything you'd had up to your Sunday league days.
Yeah, we went down there. We got changed in the porter cabins behind the goal. But you had a really, really good team on the pitch.
Yes.
With a decent manager. You know, you could see that clearly. You know, and I'm sure that was part of Tony's thinking in terms of the bigger picture.
I mean, we were told that or that you couldn't play football like that in League One and be successful. And you know, what did the other teams think of the way that Brighton were actually playing that season?
Yeah, I remember the team that we played against. Obviously, you had Elliot Bennett, and I was up against Gary Dicker.
Mm-hmm.
I remember walking off the pitch thinking, not only are they decent individual players, but they had a real system of playing.
Yeah.
And when I was at Oldham, it was a long time ago, and football's moved on that much. More teams now have a way of playing throughout probably the whole football club. But back then, it depended who your manager was and how he saw the game being played. And you know, we didn't sort of get the same sort of coaches as what Brighton had, probably at the same time. And you could see the huge difference. Yeah. You know, there were players just challenging you all over the pitch.
I mean, obviously, we were League One champions that league that year, but you did win it the year after.
Well, the Charlton time, yes, yeah. We did. I think we set record points as well, didn't we?
It's highly possible. I mean, but tell us about your time at the Valley, because I'm going to be honest with you, that's the first time you really came on my radar when you scored against us the following season, direct from a corner.
Yeah, you know what? It was a hugely important move for me. Obviously, I had a previous spell for a couple of months at Southampton, but you know, the time I was obviously leaving Bolton, I was leaving a lot of my family and friends. I think for 6 months it was difficult. You know, I was getting picked up from Bolton and dropped in the middle of London, which is a fright for any northern young lad.
Yeah, absolutely.
but it was hugely important for me in terms of learning about life. You know, sort of growing up away from what I'd been used to for so long. So for probably 4 to 6 months was a difficult period, but the time after it, you know, I really enjoyed it. It was hugely successful on the pitch, you know, and that obviously that's the most important bit, because once that's right, you sort of enjoy your life a little bit more off the pitch. And, you know, it's unbelievable, two and a half years.
Yeah, I mean, and Charlton's a club that, I mean, most Brighton fans have got quite a big affinity with because of the various things that that club's been through, similar to us, and the way they supported us during Fans United in 97 as well. It was pretty much incredible. Actually, that brings me nicely on to the other point I was going to ask, because obviously you've played for both Oldham, you play for Bury. These are important clubs in the Northwest. So when you look and see what's happened to them now, I mean, how does that make you? What do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's disappointing. It's disappointing. I understand when people come into football clubs and they want to do well, they want to challenge, and they want to be supportive financially. But I think that can't be at a cost of the future of a football club. I think it's something that needs sort of regulating, if possible. Yeah, because to see them where they are now and starting to get at the bottom of the pyramid is it's difficult, because I owe that football club a lot. You know, I was sort of at a period where I was either going into like a building trade, or I was getting an opportunity to play football, and they give me that. And I'm actually playing in a charity match for Bury Legends, or I think Bury All Stars, at the end of May. Yeah, so I'm hoping to see a few of the faces that was in that team that year.
But it's looking like the warring factions between the various different Bury teams that were trying to get going. It looks like they're actually talking to each other now, and they're actually going to come together and be one team at Gig Lane again.
Right, and on a steel question, Dale, did you get a right record points total? I think, I don't know if it's a record, but it's certainly a high one. You got 101 points that season. Sheffield Wednesday got 93. Sadly, they got promoted. And I'll ask the pair of you, can you name the four teams that made the playoffs that year? So we're talking about the year after we went up from League One, AD.
Peterborough?
Nope.
Huddersfield,
they're the ones that came up. The other three you'd have had would have been Sheffield United. They ended up with 90 points and still didn't go up.
All right. Well, there we go.
MK Dons, and sneaking into sixth place, I give you Stevenage.
St. Ebenage. There we go. Yes. But the other thing is that goal that Dale scored directly from the corner was never actually credited to him.
Why?
It was Johnny Jackson got given it.
What happened, Dale?
He probably did touch on the line or something. I actually can't
Must
remember
have done,
the goal.
Because I went through all the records and I remember it. I remember it really, really well.
I remember Dale being credited. I think we were in the press box that day.
Yeah, we were, yeah.
I think it was a game that finished 2-2. Certainly Dale was credited on the day as getting the goal, but I couldn't tell you who scored first. Maybe CMS, but I don't know. But
CMS scored
to
twice.
To be fair, Johnny Jackson does get goals, and he will nick yours to get an extra one. I know that for sure.
AD, he is what I would call the Fabrizio Romano of footballers.
Oh, the tapping merchant.
Tapping merchant, yes.
There we go. Okay, well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show, as ever, is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil has given us another lovely shirt to have a look at this week. Dale, do you want to have a go at describing this one for me?
Red, white, very checkered-y. Would you call it checkered-y?
Looks like tyre tracks to me.
Yeah,
blood splattered.
It looks like someone's been run over by a series of razor blades.
Yeah, it's quite horrific, I've got to say.
Is that a home shirt or an away shirt? Just for a clue.
For a clue, I will tell you that is a it's a home shirt.
No.
Yep.
Who has got a shirt that revolting? Sorry, I would say it's sponsored. The main sponsor across the chest is it says New Hastings, and well, it says 223-1066. Now, whether that's a clue to the fact that the team might be Southeast based, although the badge is kind of a red shield with three white stripes on it. Phil has been mucking about in Photoshop with it, but it looks like it's kind of got the lamb and flag thing that I would associate with Preston North End. However, if it says New Hastings, yeah. Is there a nicknamed the lamb and flag down in Hastings? So
I'll put you out of your misery, but I mean, if only we had a guest that, on the show that used to play for this team.
It's
Dale.
Can't be Southampton.
No, it's not Southampton. I'll put you out of the misery. And this is what Phil has got to say about this shirt this week. And he said, here is your shirt of the week. This is the home shirt of Drawlston FC. I think this was used in 1997 to 1999. Drawlston were formed in 1892 and go by the nickname of the Bloods. That explains the blood-splattered shirt then. Home was the 3,000 capacity Butcher's Arms ground. Sadly, due to COVID, the club withdrew from the Northern Premier League in 2020 and to date have yet to restart, although there is a concerted effort from the owner of the club to get them playing again next season. The side have played as high as the National League in 2008 and have made it through to the second round proper of the FA Cup three times in 1978, 2008 and in 2010, when they lost after extra time in a replay against Orient. Historically, they've been quite a successful non-league side in the Greater Manchester area, with 15 Manchester Senior and Premier Cups and a handful of league titles. One notable former player is Arthur Alberston, who made his name with 379 league appearances for Manchester United between 74 and 88, before he travelled the leagues, finishing his career at Drawsden in 94. A couple of links to the Albion include the legend that is Dave Cameron, the striker who never scored for us and was subbed early in the first half away at Hull by Mickey Adams and did not play for us again. Naturally, he promptly scored against us the following season whilst playing for Lincoln City. They've also spent a couple of years at Drawsden between 2004 and 2006. Liam Dickinson was with us between 2009 and 2010, scoring 4 in 27. He finished his career with the Bloods in 2018. And of course, the most notable player and Albion link is Dale Stevens. Dale made 7 league appearances for Drawsden in 2007 whilst on loan from his first club, Bury. By 2011, he was at Charlton, and in 2014, we know all this, but as it happens, he says, in my collection, I had Dale's Premier League match shirt from the game against Southampton in October 2017, which was auctioned off for the Poppy Day appeal for the Royal British Legion. So thank you for that, Phil. Of course, you can see that and over 130,000 others over at oldfootballshirts.com, which is well worth an hour of your time.
Okay, and you're listening to Radio Reverb. This is the Albion Raw with AD and Al. We're talking to Dale Stevens. So we spent the first part of the show talking about his life before his balls dropped. Now we get to January 2014. How did it come about that you joined the Albion? What was the interest? Were you interested in leaving Charlton, or was the sniff around too good for you to pass up?
Probably a bit of both, really. I think I had 6 months left on my contract at Charlton, so I was up in the summer. And to be fair, a lot of it was to do with Nathan Jones. I think he just left Charlton. And obviously joined Brighton.
Yeah.
And I think I was coming back from an injury, and I played for, he was a 23s manager at this point for the at Charlton. So I played for his 23s team, I think two or three times. And, you know, I say this to the young players I speak to now, he's trying to keep good relationships no matter who you're trying to play for.
Yeah.
Because eventually, obviously, he went on to be assistant manager under Oscar. And I'm not even sure Oscar had seen much of me, to be honest. I think he obviously I played against us that season. Mm-hmm. But in terms of actually knowing what I was about, it was more like Jonesy putting his head in the line to make the signing.
Yeah, because, I mean, it was a deadline day signing as well. So, I mean, talk us through the drama. I mean, how soon in advance did you know? And did it all just happen like that overnight?
Yeah, it was quick. I think we had a game against Doncaster. It was on a Tuesday night away in Doncaster. I think I was on a booking And the manager, Chris Powell, took me off. So obviously he knew that the move was going to happen.
Right.
So he took me off, so I didn't carry a suspension in terms of moving forward. He didn't want to obviously hinder the deal. I think he knew it was going to happen anyway. So yeah, he took me off about 75 minutes. And, I did actually get the chance to say goodbyes the next day because we were off. I think it was a Wednesday. And then Wednesday came, I wrote a goodbye on the whiteboard to the lads and signed it. And then I was in the car down to the South Coast.
Oh, right. So did you get the sort of like the grand tour of the stadium? Because I'm not sure that Lancing had been built by then, had it? What else did you get? I mean, was it all the pier and the seafront and the seagulls crapping on your head? I mean, what was your first thoughts about sort of having a look around the place?
Well, they kept the university training ground hidden from me on that day.
This is not the first time we've heard this.
Yeah. There was no tour of that facility. We literally just went straight to the Amex. And obviously I played there, so I knew what it was like.
Yeah.
And it was, we signed a contract overlooking the pitch in the big office, which I thought was nice. I could just see yourself, and like any player would, you look through the grass onto the pitch with the heaters on it. It was, it looked like a special place. And luckily I made that jump to the South Coast because we've got, amazing memories for a long time.
And then you realise, hang on, the home dressing room is a bit nicer than the away one.
To be fair, the away one's very good to what I've seen, on my journey to Brighton. I've been to Accrington Stanley away dressing room. That's quite small.
Fast forwarding, there was the game at Burnley, the last game of the season during lockdown, and you had to get changed. I think it was in a boardroom or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, to be fair, a few football clubs did that. I think we went to Norwich, and that was like in a sports bar.
Right.
I think wherever you've got a bit of space, obviously within the rules of whatever COVID rules there were, it was obviously 2 meters apart, so everyone had to sit 2 meters apart. Yeah, the managers' meetings were, very different. He was miles away from everybody. You couldn't really get a lot of information in terms of like tactics, sports stuff. But we tried our best with what we had.
How did you settle in with Oscar?
Oscar was quite quiet, to be fair. Jonesy doing a lot of the coaching. Obviously, Jonesy was quite fluent in Spanish, so he knew the message to deliver to the players. So it was Oscar's ideas, and what you saw was Oscar's brain. But it was Jonesy who was doing the on the field coaching. And I think he's brilliant. But Oscar was very quiet. I didn't really speak to him the day that I signed. The day I trained, his English wasn't great at that time, and everything sort of went through Jonesy with me.
Oh, right. That's interesting. So how do you think your first half season went?
Not too great, to be honest. I remember we played Leeds at home, playing against a young Cal Phillips. I think it was my first home game, because first game was Watford away, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. Lost 2-0.
We got beat 2. But you know what? Through my career, I've never started fantastically. I think it might be like a change in environment from what you were used to before. But it's always took me 3 or 4 games to get into the groove of obviously playing in a new team and with new teammates. I don't know if that's just what happened to me or how I processed it, but it's always been the same.
Well, I mean, I'm just looking at that team that you made your debut in there. I mean, there were some great players in there, David Rodriguez, and Jonathan Abika as well. But we, it was Kushak, Bruno, Greer, Ward, Upson, Keith Andrews, Dale Stevens, and Dre Orlandi, JFC, Lopez, and Ojoa. And there was a Bresman dunk called a Solly on the bench. Abika Lualua as well. It was, it was decent names there. And, and some would go on to be absolute legends at the club.
Yeah, and you know what it was? Because I knew, obviously, you guys were flying in the league and you were playing a brand of football that I'd probably not seen. And we'd just gone up with Charlton and survived, just about survived in the second season. And you was miles ahead of where we were. So I was probably a little bit trying to impress. I saw these players, we played against them, they passed us off the park. So I saw the likes of Gordon Greer, Matty Upson and Keith Andrews. And I held them above my regard. So I was trying to impress them. I was trying to impress the manager. And it probably went against me a little bit.
Yeah. But I mean, you scored your first goal for the club, where Blackburn, brilliant header. Talk us through it.
I think I came on, didn't I? Did I come on at 60 minutes. Did I start that game?
It was a last minute equaliser in a 3-3 draw, which we know all about this week.
Well, it's nice. Just about every footballer we've ever spoken to can remember every single aspect of their career, especially their first goal. And you're going, did I start that game?
I remember the goal.
Right.
I remember the goal. Jesse Lingard went down the left, checked back in. It was like an in-swinging cross, and I just glanced it in the net. I remember the goal, but I can't remember if it was the year that I came on.
I'll send out AD the Ferret to have a look to see if we can find that out. Because, I mean, obviously we got to the playoffs with Ulloa's last minute header, and the place goes absolutely mad. And then probably the less said about the playoffs, the better. I think we'll
half time. Half time. You came on at half time.
Memory's not so bad.
There you go. Then Oscar decided he wanted to go, and Sammy Hupia came in. Now this is one of those things that I always think about with a historical consideration. Is that obviously Sammy Hupia had a great playing career. Played alongside and against some of the greatest in the game. Went to Germany, co-managed a side, albeit I think that the other fellow was kind of considered to be the talent. Could you get your head around what Sammy was trying to achieve? Because I'll say this in all fairness and honesty, us fans couldn't. And all I'm ever thinking is, was he Roberto Di Zerbi, but with the players who didn't get what he was on about? Or was he a complete fruit loop?
I think he went, obviously, he started off great, and then once the pressure built up, he became a real overthinker. He got really, really intense. But when he first came in, obviously, I was injured the whole time he was there.
Yeah.
But I tried to see the sessions. Obviously, I watched every game, especially the home games. And the way what he was set up was probably too far where we were at that point. I think if you got a manager who tried to set up like that now in the Premier League, you talk about deserving. I think you'll probably get more out of it because the system that he tried to play was very attacking. He tried to get, you know, overloads in the centre of the park, which obviously most managers try to do now, especially that's how we went when Graham was here. So I think you're probably seeing more of that type now, but I think for what we were at that time, it was probably too early for us.
I'm genuinely seized by this enigma was he just, do you think, maybe too far ahead of his time, or was it maybe just right manager, wrong time?
I think probably at that level, we weren't seeing a lot of what he tried to do. We see it more now in the top division. But I think it was difficult to implement that in especially who we were playing against. Oh, you know the Championship, it's difficult.
Yes.
Yeah.
And especially I remember speaking to the centre midfielders, and I think Danny Holler, Rowan Ince and Jake Caskey was playing that year. And we played like a three, but he wanted the two lateral midfielders to go as fullbacks. Now, I could understand that. I wasn't really on the training pitch every day. And they were confused about it. But I think you see it. I think you see it now. You see fullbacks going to the midfield. I think you see midfielders go out of fullback. I mean, the only constant challenge in the Championship that you're guaranteed is that you have to be so solid defensively.
Yeah.
And I think the way we tried to play was very, very expansive. You know, to learn that through pre-season and it not start to work, I think it's hard for Sammy to then revert back to a style that Chris eventually developed in us. Because I think the difference between the two was we were very, very solid, but then we had a lot of quality. So Chris did a lot of work in terms of showing up what we had.
Yeah.
You know, trying to keep, first and foremost, a possibility of winning the game by getting a clean sheet.
Mm-hmm.
That was his message. Did a lot of work on it in training because he inherited a system where we sort of built up with two defenders and three midfielders. You see it a little bit now where De Zerbi builds up with, obviously, Duncan and a partner. Mm. They build up in a two. But I just think that takes a long time. And if it's obviously not working, then you suffer. Yeah, what managers suffer, and then they go against what you believe. And that is the challenge.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
And it takes such a long time to start again. So when Chris what were your initial thoughts of Chris when he came in?
I was excited by the appointment. Obviously, we weren't banging trouble, but we could see we were going to be in trouble if things didn't change. And I think it was a perfect appointment at the perfect time, really, considering like where we were, the period we'd had over 6 months. And he was, like, for me personally, he was brilliant because obviously I'd been out for 10 months injured, not played at all. And then he come in, I just got back fit. And he showed a great show of faith in me and in terms of, he bled me back in the Cardiff game. I came off the bench and I think I started at Millwall. I actually played left wing, believe it or not. But he started to get minutes in my legs, and it was exactly what I needed. But it works both ways, I guess. Obviously, I want to try and be a coach one day, and you have them relationships with players who you feel you can trust. And I was one of them players that he thought he could trust.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking about the recruitment. We had one season where we had Chris O'Grady, Leon Best, Emmanuel Ledesma, and Mustafa Carriol come in, and then the season after, completely different. Gaetan Bong, Toma Hennard, Liam Rossignol, Uwe Hummelmeier, Bobby Zamora all came in. You know, this was a club going, we were moving back in the right direction again. And that season, talk to me about those long unbeaten runs.
It was incredible. It was almost like replicating what I went through with Charlton at a higher level. And you know what? Like I said, the way we settled with obviously Chris's team, I knew we'd have half a chance if we had, obviously we had Knockhart and Glenn. They would win us football matches by themselves. So the rest of us, we knew our job in terms of get the ball to these good players and we've got half a chance. And we were so like solid defensively. Obviously we had Stocko in goal, Duncan, Duff, the two centre-halves, me and Baram, and then just give the ball to the lads who will score goals. Mm. And they did it more often than not. And that's a massive contribution of why we had the success that we had.
I think you've just basically described a modern-day version of Brian Clough's hod carriers and violinists, haven't you?
There you go.
But we've got to move forward a little bit. But, I mean, we just wanted to know whether you've ever actually sent Mike Dean a Christmas card.
I have not. You know what? I actually seen Mike in the airport.
What?
I was travelling back from Southampton game. We're both flying to Manchester. I actually had a chat with him. He never said he made a mistake, but he sort of acknowledged and had the conversation like he had. So I sort of gave him and accepted that a little bit, as best I could anyway.
Now, Dale, I mean regular listeners to this show will know that we've never really quite been able to let this go. And we're still absolutely fuming about it. Why was Ramirez allowed to wear a kid's shin pads to start with?
How did he get away with knocking the yellow card out of Mike Dean's hand so that he could brandish you a red? See, that's the mistake. Mike Dean was about to give you a yellow card before El Stroppy Pants knocked it out of his hands and gave, I think that the rest of the football world was disgusted. But, I mean, like I say, surely, I mean, maybe diplomacy needs to kick in here. But, I mean, the rest of us would have wanted to knock him into the middle of next week.
It was a couple of years after I saw him, to be fair. So I've sort of digested it at this point. But, yeah, that was a day that obviously really stands out in when I look back over the career and stuff. For different reasons, obviously, you got the red card and stuff. And then
but you scored
goal.
As well.
Yeah, you got the goal, another header somehow. Yeah. But even like leaving the training ground, we had all the staff out on the car park, obviously cheering us away and wishing us obviously good best wishes and etc. Mm-hmm. And it just the build up of the day. We had the fire alarm go off at 3 o'clock in the morning. Some of the Middlesbrough fans apparently set the fire alarm off. So it was a huge event, painful one at the end. But I think obviously we did what we did the year after, which I've sort of.
Yeah.
Forgiven what happened the year before.
Do you think that we would have been ready to go up that season? Or was that extra year in the Championship helpful?
Hindsight, maybe it helped, maybe it didn't. You know, I don't think we'll ever know. And I think we probably would have had a similar sort of first Premier League season. You know, we weren't finishing mid-table. We're always the challenges, like the first 2-3 years, is just, try and stay at that level. I think we'd have tried and aspired to be a Premier League club, even if we went up that year. Would have been difficult, like the following 2 years was as well. But luckily we did it the following year.
But it's one of those things you actually want to do consider is that if you hadn't have got that red card, all right, if we'd have still drawn, but if you hadn't have got that red card, you'd have been then available for the playoffs. And let's face it, given how many people ended up limping off at Hillsborough, we'd have certainly needed you. And it's kind of. One of those hindsight things, you think, well, how much better we have done if you'd have been available. But obviously with that evening at the Amex, the second leg, I've said this so many times on this show, that the atmosphere at that night, especially before the game, was so loud. I mean, I'm halfway up the West Stand up and it was so loud. By the time the final whistle goes and we haven't made it. Yeah. Now, we've seen on various videos about what the club's attitude was. obviously you weren't on the pitch itself, but you're very much part of the squad. But, you know, what was the feeling at the time? I mean, was it just utter desolation, or was that fight already there?
I remember the game very well. I think we must have had 5-6 clear cut chances first half. Yeah. You talk about the atmosphere. I think that's the best I've seen the Amex for the duration that I've been there. Yeah. And you talk about obviously the game before where I'm suspended. I think you remember Dunkey gets sent off against Derby. He's suspended.
Yes.
He missed the Middlesbrough one and obviously the first leg. We had Connor Goldson playing, didn't we?
Yes.
You know, he not played too much that year, but I thought he was fantastic against Middlesbrough.
Did a fantastic job, yeah.
And then I think he was one of the guys that limped off in the first leg, wasn't he?
Certainly, Knockhart did. I lose track of it. I think Sidders did, didn't he? I lose track of who it was, but yeah.
But we got most of the team obviously back. But Dunkey was back in the team, huge player for us at that period.
Yeah.
But yeah, it sort of felt we had so many chances, and then we got hit on the break with a sucker punch, and it was difficult to swallow.
Sure.
You know, we felt that we went through, you know, obviously the Middlesbrough game, a bit of injustice. Then we had three injuries in 45 minutes in the first leg. It just felt, especially afterwards, when you conceded against Sheffield Wednesday at home, it just felt it wasn't supposed, you know, to happen for us there and then.
It's the gods of football offloading their fate onto you. And of course, then, you know, look what happened later was that, you know, you had a very strong suitor come sniffing around for you. We know what we as fans wanted. But tell us about what it was like for you.
Yeah, that period was tough. You know, I was, 28?
Yeah.
I didn't say this when I was at Charlton. I had a failed move to Aston Villa after my first year at Charlton. You know, something happened internally that obviously I didn't move to the Premier League at that age. So I felt this was the right chance for me to make that jump.
Yeah.
And I understand... And thankful I didn't move at that time. But yeah, it was just a pure footballing decision. I wanted to try and test my ability in the top league. You know, it was unfortunate that I couldn't do it the previous year, you know, when we had the opportunity to go up. But yeah, there was nothing more than just I wanted to try and play at the highest level.
Listen, no one's blaming you for it. I think what it was that I think because, you know, looking at it from the club's point of view, they could have got £8 million immediately or... you know, stuck to their guns, kept you on board, told Burnley thanks but no thanks, knowing full well that reward of 100 million at the end of the season is a punt. You know, it's basically Tony Bloom putting £8 million on the table saying, right, okay, I'm going to put that down, knowing full well that we've got every chance. And I think what it was that this is certainly how we as fans felt, was we had such faith in Chris and you, you know, your team and you personally, that we were supporting the club in wanting to keep you, because I think that in not keeping you, our chances of going up to the Premier League would have been sorely scuppered. And I think that you personally were kind of such an important part of that. The fact that we can say that with hindsight doesn't change the fact that as how I felt at the time. And so given that you eventually didn't go to Burnley, tell us about, you know, that promotion season.
Do you know what? I had conversations with Chris, the manager, and the staff, and he basically said what you just said to me there. He said, we have a football club who've rejected 8 million. So the football club wants to keep you here. And this is after the window closed.
Right.
Yeah. I think I remember being on the bench for the first few games after it closed. And, you know, the conversation was like clear the air talks, basically. You want to be back playing. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be back playing. There was no benefit in me being there and not playing.
Sure.
You know, I was running, my contract had been running out. So the situation I was in was either play well or you don't get anything at the end of the season.
Yeah.
You know, whether that be at Brighton or whether that be elsewhere. So the conversation with Chris was like, he just highlighted exactly what you just said. He was a chairman who turned down a lot of money for you. You know, he's obviously shown how much he values you. And he's willing to lose it even if we don't go up this year. So it took me probably a couple of weeks to, you know, to get over the disappointment of not being able to move. But quickly to focus.
How did that conversation with Chris make you feel?
Yeah, good. Really good. I don't think I was... Obviously, I wasn't looking at it from a club's point of view or from a Brighton's point of view. I was obviously being selfish. I wanted to try and, you know, go on and play in the Premier League. You know what
at
I mean?
The end of the day, you know, I mean, it's something I say on a regular basis is the fact that, you know, it's a football club's job is to try and be as successful as they possibly can be, to try and win every single thing they're entering. And again, as a player, you want to play at the highest level for as long as you possibly can. So the fact that you were given an opportunity to do it and it didn't, I can understand that it would have hurt a little bit. But the bottom line is you did get to achieve that ambition and you did it with this football club, and we're forever grateful for it.
So, like I say, as I said before, take us through that promotion season. I mean, could you feel a strong sense? I mean, I appreciate that, like I say, your head might have been slightly elsewhere at the very beginning, but, you know, as you settled back into the team and as the season wore on, could you feel promotion was definitely, you know, there for the taking?
Yeah, because the players you brought in, I think Glenn come in that year, didn't he? Anthony come in the January prior to that. We just made really good signings. We knew we were guaranteed Goldie Glenn. I think I spoke to Glenn, you know, recently, and we speak about that, obviously, failed promotion year. And I think he was not wanting us to go up so he could join us the next year and then be a part of obviously the promotion season.
How very Glenn.
Yeah.
that's a striker for you.
Isn't it just?
Yeah. But, I mean, obviously, because, I mean, we'd lost one legend in Bobby Zamora and replaced him with Glenn Murray. So,
This is the difference, isn't it, Adi? I mean, you know, conversely, Bobby Zamora said at the end of that season, he said, if only I hadn't got injured, you know, because obviously Brighton didn't go up by virtue of two goals. He said, if it had been, you know, just an extra couple of goals that, and I could have been. And then you got Glenn saying, glad they didn't go up, then I could get some glory.
That sounds about right. But I mean, yeah, you're right. The recruitment, that was good. There were some interesting characters that turned up. I mean, Elvis Manu. I mean, you know, that was an interesting character. He did score, though. I think it was at Oxford, I believe. But yeah, I mean, that season. So, you know, again, I mean, like the season before, we went on these long, unbeaten runs, and it was just the momentum was growing and growing and growing, and in the stands we could feel something growing. On the pitch, you must have felt it as well.
Yeah. Well, the point is, Adi, so I've got to cut across here. The point is that it was absolutely vital that we got promotion because we're so rubbish at the playoffs. So we had to bypass them. But, you know, and again, when you hear back the you know, with hindsight, the board saying after that sort of Sheffield Wednesday disappointment, and then you go on and the season started the next day and everyone came back in and you know, obviously the club had to deal with this sort of this issue. But it was, in the great scheme of things, you know, the squad was enough to carry on the good work. And then Dale came back in and we hit the afterburners again. So, you know, sorry, I'm ranting here, Dale, but I think you probably have to appreciate that as good as these things are for a player, it's just absolutely magical. Yeah. For us as fans, so, I mean, did you feel the connect?
Yeah, we loved it. Obviously, most of us at this point, we were in sort of Brighton and the Hove area.
Yeah.
So we could feel it. We walked down the beach, you know, you had conversation with fans. You go to Tesco, you get reminded about Palace games, you know, when we win the Premier League. It'll be about Palace. But, you know, especially that year, it was just solely promotion because we'd missed out on it so, you know, so finally the year before. But, yeah, listen, it's a special place. Especially now, it's obviously a connected place, the football club with the city. You know, it's a special place to be in. And I think it probably grew from that period of missing out up until now that you see like it is now.
Mm. So, okay, so let's fast forward to I mean, that season. And at what point did you think we've got this in the bag? Or was it the Wigan game?
You know what? No, we played Wolves away. We won 2-0. I think Anthony scored both goals.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Yeah. And Glenn got the ump.
That was Easter.
Oh, he was fuming. Glenn was fuming that day.
You could see.
So, yeah, we went to Wolves away, and we were singing Sweet Caroline in the changing room, and I think we had seven games left.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
we were always looking at third place rather than obviously second.
Yes.
So we knew we were in a good position, and that's probably when we started to really believe, you know, we had a really good chance of not only just getting promoted, but, you know, winning the division. which ultimately that's what we wanted to do from the start.
Yes.
Yeah. So obviously we had the opportunity. Obviously there was the Wigan game where it happened. You had the pitch invasion, and we got to
pitch invasions.
Yeah, we got to see what colour Donkey's underwear was, which is no one wants to see ever again, frankly.
Well, let me ask Dale this question. Do you remember the evening after the Wigan game? And if you did, you weren't there, I'm sure. Well, were you one of those that was crowd surfing on the train?
No, that was Ollie Norwood.
Yeah, Norwood and Sam Baldock, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think Scarlett was involved as well.
They're all under 6 foot. They were never to pick me up. No chance.
But I think also, the other thing I remember is that obviously it was a bank holiday Monday. It was dark by then because, like I say, we didn't go until the Derby Huddersfield game had finished. Players were being carried shoulder high down Queen's Road. And I think Nocky started up with a chant of, "We want you to stay, Dale Stevens, we want you to stay." And then I realised there was this chap called Dale Stevens who was joining in.
They were saying, "Give him some money." That's what he was singing. So that's why I joined in.
Then you sang that at the parade as well, though, didn't you?
No, that was a song about my former football club, isn't it?
Yes.
So the Wigan celebrations were brilliant. Yeah, right. I mean, that game of Villa, I mean, you know, Marcel gets the penalty, 1-0 up. It's all going well. And, you know, Bruno was getting ready to lift the trophy. And then to lose the lead in that fashion in the last minute, that actually meant you didn't actually get the trophy. It must have been an absolute kicker.
It really was, because we wanted to win that division. We felt like we deserved to win that division. To concede so late on, I felt they were in full control. And Stocky's come out, you know, after the game in a change, we apologised for his, you know, it wasn't really his mistake. I think we should block the shot anyway. But to concede a poorish goal defensively, and then for that to have such an influence on us not winning the league, it felt like we'd not been promoted. Because we celebrated, I think it was 2-3 games before that promotion.
Yeah,
yeah.
But then the spin-off goal was, obviously, we want to win the division. It was clear for everyone to, you know, we didn't have that much work to do. I think we needed 3 points from 3 games, it might have been.
Something like that, yeah, yeah.
It should have been doable.
Yeah, lost at Norwich, lost at home to Bristol City, and then drew with Villa.
Well, we lost to Norwich with them not having a shot on target. Go figure.
Oh. It was two free kicks off the post, wasn't it?
That's it, yeah. Yeah, hit the back of Stocko's head and went in. But, I mean, again, for us fans, the victory parade during that summer with the duck egg blue sky and 100,000 people lining the route, those are the things that surely any professional lives for, isn't it?
Yeah, it was honestly incredible. We as players, we didn't really know what to expect. Obviously, we knew there was a bus parade. It could have been, you know, a couple of thousand people, but for the city to turn out the way it did, it was just extra special to top that year off. All the families were involved. You know, it was United City, and, you know, their memories will stay with you forever. You know, there's pictures of, and then obviously we did the parade, and then we would go to the stage. I unfortunately did a worm for everybody.
It looked good.
And then I wouldn't be able to get off the floor now, to be fair.
That's where your ankle injury came from.
we did get promoted, and, you know, the Premier League was a great big adventure for all of us. You know, we hadn't been there since 1983, and, you know, it was just amazing. And obviously we had the champions coming down for the first game of the season, and you know, these are the players you wanted to test yourself against, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we could have started with an easier game than Man City at home.
Could have done.
But we were definitely thrown in the deep end. And I think, you know, a lot of our squad were put together. We didn't have many Premier League appearances between us, really. So in that respect, that could probably go against you. But I think everybody had a point to prove that we are Premier League players. This is where we want to play. So every single week, we had a driver, not only to keep the club in the Premier League, but we want to show players and obviously other clubs that we've just promoted, and we deserve to be. Well, certainly that's where my ambition came from.
Yeah. Sure. But you've played at the club for a long time. You had a lot of midfield partners there. Going into the Premier League, you had number two, basically. You had Davy Purper come in and Pascal Gross.
To be fair, Davy's probably up there with one of the best players I've seen in terms of technically the way he deals with the football. Obviously, he's Dutch. He's going to be a decent football player. But I felt he was probably a little bit underrated, if you like. Having him at the side of me, he could deal with the ball. He could pass it left foot, right foot. And he would deal with it. And he had a change of pace. He could go past players. And I've always said him, obviously, during my career, the hardest players to play against in a midfield position are the guys that can go past you. I think prior to, obviously, the last 5-6 years, midfield players have predominantly been passers. But I think what we're seeing now is that people like Bissouma, he was one of the best I've played against or trained against in terms of he could go past you either side. And for me, it was a nightmare to play against that type of player. And I'm just glad David was at the side of me on my team rather than me.
But what were your Premier League highlights for the Albion?
Certainly the debut, even though we were beat. I think we were in the game for a long spell. Obviously, my goal staying up the Man United game at the Amex, where we, obviously that was the game we stayed up after winning that.
Many beers after that one, yeah.
Yeah, but it was
goal line technology.
Yeah, it was certainly more feeling of relief rather than obviously excitement that you've achieved something. It was more and just breathe because the pressure was on for weeks before that. Yeah, and so much work had gone on to get to that point. We didn't want to just do it once, and then become a team that comes up and down. To get that stability of the first year, and do it against Man United at home against the packed Amex was special.
But I mean, did you feel that the influence of Tony Bloom was growing on the squad, the way that the recruitment was happening, the players were getting better and better? And obviously the first few years under Chris, it was all about survival. It was getting better. And obviously we got to the Cup semi-final. We'll talk about that in a minute because we've got another one coming up. The influence from the top, how the players must have felt that a little bit, right?
Yeah, we did. And to be fair, I've always said this about Brighton. It's the football club's transparent in terms of, you'll see Tony around the training ground. He'll have lunch in the training ground with his players. And from the first day I walked in, the ambition was to be a top 10 Premier League football club. Now, at that time, it was probably, taken with a pinch of salt, but he knew what he wanted. Mm. He knew he wanted Lewis Dunk to drive his football club. That's what he wanted. And I think he's done it really well in terms of he's invested so much in the stadium first, and then obviously an unbelievable facility for the lads to train in. And then he sort of invested heavily on the pitch. I don't think we were overspending in terms of trying to gain promotion. Mm. I think we were probably been in the top 10 in terms of the budget, what players were earning, what club we were spending. So to do it like that, to invest in obviously the foundation of football club has probably set it to where it is now. In terms of he's invested on the pitch more and more over the last 2-3 years.
Sure.
But the work he's done for all that time, he's foreseen that. And it probably helps. He's a huge Brighton fan and he wants Brighton Football Club to be as competitive as they can be. And I think we're seeing that now.
Yeah, but one of the things that he did do was he had to make a tough decision. It was a tough season. I mean, losing 5-0 at home to Bournemouth, losing at home to Cardiff was probably a lot to take. And there was a lot of people were shocked when Chris Hughton got sacked. But, I mean, how did the players take that?
Yeah, it was a shock. Look, we knew we were disappointed for the previous two. I think we went down to 10 men against Bournemouth. I think Knockhart got sent off.
He did. Yep.
We weren't great for the period leading up to, obviously, Chris losing his job. And it was a shock to the players. We felt like we were trying to stabilise and that was the ambition. But no, I think Tony, obviously, he had a bigger picture in his mind and he knew to get better in that division, he probably needed to change manager. And I think you've seen, obviously, the journey from Chris to Graham, probably in terms of points at the end of both seasons wasn't too different. But I think what the football club, what Tony was seeing was evidence of, in terms of playing style, was more suited for Brighton's rise probably than it was from a Chris style. You probably saw the evidence on the pitch before you saw the results. And it's something that Tony probably seen along with the board and the staff that were identifying it.
Well, I think this is probably one of those reasons as to why, given last season, we had this run of losing six in a row, and then there was another run of not winning 11 in 11, and so on and so forth. But I think, again, people could see there had been something bigger than evolution. Well, probably a bit far to call it revolution, but the difference between Chris and Graham in terms of their approach, certainly from what we as fans saw, was remarkable. Was it a gear crunch for you as a player?
Yeah, it was different in terms of we do a lot of work in terms of obviously setting up to play out from the back, etc. And he wanted his team to be aggressive and press high. Where we obviously under Chris's management, we were more like mid block, low block, very defensive. But yeah, he isolated. We would play 1v1 at the back, which the two centre halves wasn't really used to. So there was a lot of things changing in terms of trying to get to where we wanted to be. But I also feel like he inherited a really strong, like, not defensive team, but we had good defenders who could defend. Yeah. And I think he inherited that probably from Chris rather than actually coaching it into us. He was more coaching the other side in terms of we have to be playing this way. And I learned so much under Graham in 12 months. And he's probably the guy that made me want to be a coach and a manager, because the way he saw the game was, seen it for 30 years before that.
We'll come to the coaching bit in a minute. So, you know, with the fact that now, 2 years after you've left Brighton, you've hung up your boots, and you can sort of look at things from a different perspective. And as you say, you're talking about coaching, but in terms of that, you know, you were talking about the difference between Chris and Graham, but you're getting to observe from you know, not being within part of that now, the difference between Graham and Roberto De Zerbi. So what is it that you're seeing on the pitch for the Albion that sort of maybe you can pick up ideas from?
In terms of how he sets up his team?
And the whole lot.
Okay, well, obviously, I still speak to, obviously, to Dunkey. And I've getting information from him. He's just, I think his mentality is he's just a winner. I think he's getting that through to his players over a period of time. You know, I think it's easy for people to say, oh, but he's a winner. If you win a football match, he's a winner. But I think he got asked a question a couple of weeks back in terms of, was it the FA Cup or Champions League? And he didn't flinch. He said both straight away. and I think that's probably, you know, a synopsis of what he's like as a manager. Unfortunately, I didn't train underneath him. I've not played against him, but I speak to still some of the guys, Jason Steele, Pascal, and obviously still Lewis. I think he's very similar in terms of the way he wants to try and play through thirds. Mm. But I just think his mentality is probably more aggressive in terms of he wants to go, you know, and score as many goals as he can against opposition teams. And I think that's probably been the biggest difference in terms of Graham and De Zerbi. So,
okay, I mean,
that's just an analysis from watching it and seeing.
Okay,
what the guys
we'll take that point. I mean, under Graham, for the first 2-3 years, there was the issue was putting the ball in the back of the net. We're playing this beautiful, expansive football. It was very easy on the eye, but we just weren't finishing off the chances that we're creating. We became Brighton and XG Albion, didn't we? With the same personnel, we're now scoring those chances. And then you look and see what's happened at Chelsea and you're seeing the same. What's the difference? I mean, how has Roberto actually managed to like add end product to all of this?
I think from watching Brighton this year, I think Brighton sort of build up in a two, whereas under Graham, it was more in a back three.
Right.
I think it's quite, you know, it's adventurous in terms of you can get hit on the break, the transition is dangerous, but I think they have so much control in terms of possession in football matches. You see the two centre-halves, obviously Dunkey and a partner, they're well into the opposition's half. So they have so much control from that position. I think they're allowed to, you know, commit more bodies into the box. I think McAllister's got 10 goals this year. Mm-hmm. You know, Evan Ferguson's chipped in since he's got his debut. I think they spread the goals across, you know, they're attacking players, but it's just good to see them be that brave. But that comes from the manager. There's not many teams who will build up with two centre halves and the rest of the players advance to their two strikers. Yeah.
Had Evan come in when you were still at the club? I can't remember if he was. Must have been
not when I was still at the club. I trained with him in pre-season. He looks like a special talent. To be fair, he's got all the attributes. He's big. He's strong. He's quick and he's still such a young boy. He's going to learn so much over the next couple of years.
And when you signed for Brighton Hove Albion, did you ever think that you'd have played with the World Cup winner?
Do you know what? I knew he was top player. I've said this all along. it's an incredible achievement, isn't it?
Yeah,
incredible achievement. Absolutely. And obviously, to be associated with the football club, it's just an amazing story.
It is. I mean, a lot of these players that you've played with most of them, pretty much, haven't you? So, I mean, and obviously with pre-season, and you're seeing what's going on with Carew and everything else now. But you know, I mean, when you were with us pre-season, obviously still hoping that you might have caught Graham's eye and maybe he might give you an extra year, obviously.
You know me too well.
Yeah. But, you know, when you're up close and personal with these guys and, you know, it's special. But, I mean, for you, when you're having that conversation with Graham, I mean, you still had another year in your contract at the time, I think. So, I mean, could you have stayed or were you just desperate to go and play somewhere?
Well, the issue I still had... obviously, an extra year on my contract. But the issue is we had he's Bissouma coming through. And I saw him every day for 2 years. And I knew he was ready to play. And he's an exceptional talent. And I thought I wouldn't play as much as what I had for the previous six. So I had the conversation with Graham. And he said, look, you might not start the season, but you'll definitely play. You know, and probably my ego got in the way of me a little bit in terms of being this mainstay for 5-6 years prior to that. But me trying to preempt my following season, if I'd not played much, because I thought Biss was a terrific player and I thought he would play a majority of the season, which he went on to do and had an unbelievable year. Yeah, the focus then become, I need to be going playing as many games as I can. You know, while I'm still 31 years old, I've still got a couple of years left or a few years left, as I thought back then. I was going to a football club that really wanted me for two out of the last 5 years. You know, the manager's still there who tried to sign me twice. And all this just came into effect. And, you know, when the club's getting money back and you've still got a year left, it sort of saves the year's salary and you get some money back. It made sense to the football club to sell at the right time. And it was just more of a yes for everybody. And myself included at the time, but I probably should have stayed now.
hindsight is always a wonderful thing, but... But by the same token, I guess a football career is actually too short to have those kind of regrets because it'll only ever eat you up. And the point is that, as you've since mentioned, you know, there's always the footballer's career part two, which is going into coaching. So with that in mind, what's next? And B, obviously, given the variety of managers you've worked under and the style of football you've seen around the country, is there a particular sort of style or a particular ethos that you're a particular fan of?
Yeah, I think obviously the game's changed from in terms of when I was a player coming through. Everything was more 4-4-2, very direct. I'd come through at League Two level, so I'd seen quite a bit, obviously, getting up the divisions and up the leagues. But I probably learnt most from Graham in terms of I was 30 years old. I'd not seen... Obviously, I didn't play under Gus. I think Gus was probably the most similar to Graham in terms of how he set up his team. But I'd not really been coached that way throughout my career in terms of how he built up and why he was building up from the back. You know, it was to get into spaces, behind the back four and into assist areas to score goals. Hmm. And it was very structured but looked fluent.
Yes.
You know, I think the most fans would agree, I think Graham's teams looked fluent, but everybody had a role for it to look that fluent. And that's just something I've took from that. And, the next step is to go on and coach and hopefully be a manager.
No, that was the question I got, because I know you're doing the badges soon, aren't you? So you've got to do that. So you do think you want the top job or you'd be just be a number two maybe? Or is it the top job that you actually want?
No, it's definitely the manager job. You know, I think I'd get to some sort of coaching level to get experience and a bit of exposure to see what happens.
Is that because you look better in a suit or a tracksuit?
I think I got tracksuit. There's not many worse suits anymore, is there?
Have you kind of got a coaching / managerial career path, an intended one mapped out, or is it like with a lot of football, you're just going to have to see what comes along?
I think I'll go at it exactly the same way I did my playing career, to be fair. Like I said to you at the start of the interview, I didn't really look too far ahead, I think. We just look at what we can do right now and we build on that and give our best every day. And I think that's the way I'll go about it.
Sure. So, Dale, many congratulations on a pretty decent career, and certainly a career that, you know, would be, you could easily say, is a lot better than most professionals would have had. Now, given obviously that you spent the bulk of your time at the Albion, we're going to ask you this, and this is an Albion-based show. What does Brighton and Hove Albion mean to you at this point in time?
Oh, everything, to be fair. I think it took me from being probably an average Championship player to finishing my career as a Premier League player. A lot of work's gone into it, you know, a lot of sweat, and you know, but I think at some point we'll probably move back because my partner and partner's children, they're from Brighton. So at some point we'll probably return and call it home. I think that's how much I enjoyed it in terms of playing, but also living as a city, I think it's incredible.
Okay, well, that is all we've got time for. So thank you so much to Dale Stevens for joining us. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been AD Packham. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com on DAB. Of course, on our podcast and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you all again next week. Cheers. Bye.
This old house wants new children. This old house wants new wife. This old house was home of comfort as we focused on life. This old house once rang with laughter. This old house heard many shots. Now she trembles in the dark and that's the way the lane in the walls is louder. This old house is getting old. This old house that's in the rain. This old house that's in the cold. On my knees I'm getting chilled. But I feel no pain. As I see an angel beating through the broken window pane.
Ain't gonna leave this house no longer. Ain't gonna leave this house no more.
Ain't got time to fix the shingles. Ain't